Since 1975, Peter has owned and operated 13 country and metropolitan hotels. He currently owns or part owns and operates 7 hotels and a motel in Mount Gambier. To help pass the spare time, he is also President of the Australian Hotels Association in South Australia, National Senior Vice President of the Australian Hotels Association, and a board member of SA Tourism Commission, and has a long list of other credits too. Would you please welcome Peter Hurley?
Thank you, sir. I was delighted to receive the invitation to speak to you today, as anyone would be, given such a distinguished audience. However, I wasn't expecting any early intimidation, but I did notice when they opened the door over there, Steve Howard bolted straight in, down to this table, immediately in front of the lectern, for those who can't see where he is, and got the chair that has the most direct eye contact with this lectern. Obviously an intimidatory move right from the beginning. Oh, is that what it was? As I look around, I sort of get that... I know how Elizabeth Taylor's 8th husband felt on the wedding night. He knew exactly what was expected, as I do, except I'm extremely scared that it'll be boring, and I guess he felt the same. But since I represent an industry which finds itself constantly the focus of your profession, it was an opportunity I thought important to participate in. It is true that the hospitality industry peddles nearly every vice, drinking, smoking and gambling, to mention the obvious. One of the other obvious vices we leave to personnel more specialised in their suitability for it. It is equally true that many of your profession are avid supporters and consumers of our products, and so I take some comfort in the knowledge that I speak to you about an industry in which we have a strong and mutual interest. I must confess, however, that to some extent I join you today as a bit of a fraud. I say this assuming that some of you think that I'm here as one of Adelaide's pokey barons, an interesting phrase coined by I'm not sure whom, but I'll bet they're here today. Sadly, I confess that I don't fit that description. Mind you, I've yet to see a piece done by any journalist that explores any detail of what such an individual looks like or is composed of. In reality, I'm here as a small business operator, as a representative of an association of small business people whom I'm proud to represent, and as a passionate South Australia, emotional about returning this state to being a pro-business environment. Whilst our industry is multifaceted, being involved in broad-based hospitality, food and beverage, entertainment, accommodation, tourism and gambling via wagering, lotteries and poker machines, we employ some 17,000 people, and that won't be the last time I mention that number, just in case any of you have a bad memory. We employ those people 7 days a week to provide this range of services. We've been involved in delivering most of these services for many years, but it is our most recently legislated available service, that is poker machines, that seems to preoccupy your profession. A preoccupation, I would say, which ignores the fact that we write in excess of 45% of the TAB's annual turnover. It ignores the fact that the community spend on alcohol is between 2.5 and 3 times what their spend is on gaming. A preoccupation which sees more print and electronic media attention to our 10,500 machines than the New South Wales media devote to the 85,000 machines in that state. I was hoping Rex Jury was going to be here today, because I was going to have a bit of a brown nose to Rex and say that he was exempt from any negative comments that I might make today, given that he wrote that quite outstanding poker machine article some months ago, and in fact there had been moves in our industry to elevate him to the status of the new general manager that our industry was seeking, or I did even hear some people talking about him being the president of the AHA. But I would congratulate Rex on his pragmatism in that article, which several people here would be aware of, and his preparedness to move away from the bandwagon that had become could have been coined poker machine journalism. I should be careful not to be too critical of media pokey bashing, though, because every single time that there's an intensified anti-pokey campaign, that drives statewide turnover even higher. Now, why? I think it's an unavoidable conclusion that the punting public react rebelliously to any nanny state mentality arguments about what they are being told that they ought not to be spending their leisure dollar on. The main question that I think emanates from the disproportionate focus on poker machine gambling compared to the way the New South Wales media treat it is why. One can only conclude that it's because of the higher proportion of privatised gaming in South Australia. As privately owned gaming explodes in New South Wales and Queensland, maybe they have increasing media attention to look forward to. Maybe a privatised casino, lottery business or TAB in South Australia has more aggressive attention coming their way when the government eventually actions their privatisation aspirations for those gaming franchises. The media and community have ignored the fact that on-course wagering via both bookies and the tote has been in private hands virtually forever. If it is private ownership of pokies that causes the offence that seems to be caused in the minds of some, then some of the myths ought to be exposed. And I think the best way to expose them is to quote some of the statistics from a 1994 Arthur Anderson financial analysis of the club industry in New South Wales. And I am certainly not about club bashing, I assure you, but I just want to, and we're in fact in partnership, as most people would be aware, with the Licensed Clubs Association in this state, in the Independent Gaming Corporation. But the Arthur Anderson survey in New South Wales was of 11 private licensed registered clubs. Now, several important and critical statistics emerged from that in fact prove that privately owned operators are equally as generous or more generous to the community than perhaps the club industry in New South Wales. The average total donations was 3% of the net operating profit of the 11 substantial clubs that were surveyed in that survey. The income tax average was 7.2% of net operating profit, when, as everyone here knows, assuming that they have a taxable income above whatever, what's the threshold, Ian? Is it about 30 or 40,000? High 30s. Everyone above that is paying 48.7%. The Penrith Panthers paid 0.7% of their turnover. The Twin Towns Services Club paid 0.3% of their turnover in income tax. And don't think that they are a club just trading with members. They trade with the general public just as surely as Coles Myer do. The net gaming revenue of the clubs in that particular survey ranged from the Canterbury Leagues Club had the largest with $26 million in net gaming revenue. And for those who don't understand, net gaming revenue is an industry term which regrettably is a misnomer. Net gaming revenue is the international language for what really ought to be called the gross gaming revenue. So it's important to clear that up first. They range from $26 million at the Canterbury Leagues Club to $2.9 million at the Tweed Heads Golf Club. The net operating profit of those two clubs, and this is all from publicly available information, in 1994 was $6 million at Canterbury Leagues, which I happen to know was in excess of $11 million last year, and at the Tweed Heads Golf Club, although they'd had $2.9 million in net gaming revenue, which they would have had an average, they would have paid gaming tax of about 20%, I would say, on that revenue compared to our new marginal rate of 50.5. They lost $700,000 for the year, so obviously they didn't pay any income tax. But the more interesting one, and the one that's relevant to the debate about privately owned gaming versus private licensed registered club gaming, was the community-related donations as a percentage of their turnover. Canterbury RSL, 0.27%. Tweed Golf Club, the one that we just spoke about, 0.07. Sounds more like a breath analysis reading than a charity policy, doesn't it? The Rooty Hill RSL Club, a massive organisation, 0.45%. The Panthers, the largest club in Australia and probably one of the largest in the world, 0.3%. Four of the 11 that were surveyed gave nothing. So I think that helps just clear up one particular issue there. But back to our own state. As you're all aware, our most recent state budget broke the nexus of a level playing field tax structure between private licensed registered clubs and pubs and created a differential at the top marginal rate in state gaming tax of 25%. That is the difference between 40 and 50%. This differential was announced only weeks after the National Competition Council officers had advised our national office that they believed that the South Australian gaming legislation was the only model which didn't breach national competition policy by being anti-competitive, and only one day after the Prime Minister of this country gave our national executive at a meeting in Canberra, which he attended, an assurance that he would investigate the anti-competitive nature of the legislation in New South Wales and Queensland. Add the traditional mutuality exemption from income tax enjoyed by private licensed registered clubs and the huge community economic benefit of privately owned gaming becomes obvious. Now, I repeat, I have nothing against the licensed club industry at all, but I am just saying that the community benefits economically massively by comparison by having the ownership of gaming vested in private hands. Equivalent pubs and the private licensed registered clubs with a state average, and if we take an example, I'll just present verbally one model. I think it's probably fairest to use the state average number of machines here, 21 machines, and the state average net gaming revenue, which is about $104 a day as of June. I looked it up. In that circumstance, with state and federal taxes combined, the differential for an outlet between being a club and a pub is $151,000, or $7,191 per machine, additional benefit in the form of tax going to the broader community. The consequence for the privateer is that a $1 million capital expenditure program, and that's a common thing in this state now, there have been many millions, as Ian McLaughlin from SA Manco is aware, there have been many millions spent in both clubs and pubs on renovations, and a $1 million upgrade, capital expenditure renovation, is now quite a common thing. That $1 million will take 10 years to pay back for the publican who pays the tax, as compared to 4 years for the private licensed registered club, because of the extra 57.75% tax that they bear. As you can see, there is a substantial economic benefit for the wider community in privately owned gambling. We also don't expect much criticism of Mr. Packer and Mr. Murdoch's swapping of their Sky Channel monopoly for equity in the newly privatised New South Wales TAB, the largest wagering franchise in Australia. Now, as president of a substantial and growing industry association, part of my role is to lobby politicians, both state and federal, regarding issues that have a direct impact on our business. In South Australia, our industry employs 17,000 people. I promised you I'd mention it more than once. Contrary to what you might glean from local media reports, these are largely permanent and part-time and full-time jobs. Not that there's anything wrong with a part-time job. A lot of people want a part-time job. Make no mistake about that. The hospitality sector, particularly hotels, is one of the few industries offering employment growth, particularly with our state's young people. And we also employ thousands of people over 50, whom recent TV articles seem to suggest have difficulty finding employment. With the introduction of gaming to hotels, there have been approximately 4,000 new jobs created since 1994. Now, the 1996 Hill Inquiry, which we'll refer to later, into the impact of gaming machines verified that at that time there was an additional 3,000 jobs. The introduction of gaming has been one of the most controversial issues impacting on our hotels since the abolition of 6 o'clock closing. Gaming has revolutionised the hotel industry. Some sectors, which were experiencing enormous hardship since the introduction of random breath testing, this coupled with the changing community attitude, saw many hotels in our industry struggling to survive, and many of them, in fact, in receivership. Gaming saved many of these businesses. I don't back away from that, and I think it's a good thing. The South Australian model of gaming incorporates significant positive features as compared to the model that exists in other states. Take Victoria, for example. Gaming machines in hotels are strategically placed by the giant privatised Tabcorp and Tattersalls. In South Australia, by comparison, many licences are granted where an existing hotel licence or club licence holder, a small business operator, applies for and passes stringent probity checks. When properly understood, this dispels the myth that machines in South Australia are selectively placed in lower socio-economic areas. The highest number of machines per capita and the highest per capita spend on poker machines via council region is in the Kensington Norwood area, or what was the Kensington Norwood area. I think there's been an amalgamation up there now. With the lowest two being the Salisbury Council area and the Noarlunga Council area. This was verified and documented by the Hill Inquiry and should set that out plainly. Many journalists have had this concept explained to them, I know for sure, and however it seems that as it does not fit preconceived story angles, that it does not get a fair run or any reasonable analysis. Another critical feature of our model here is the 40 machine maximum. A stroke of genius, as it happened, because some of you wouldn't be aware that the legislation went through the lower house with a maximum of 100. I think it's a wonderful thing for the entire South Australian community that was amended in the upper house. Might be the only good thing I've thought about the upper house in recent times, but it is a positive thing. The average take-up of machines is 21 per venue at this stage. This is in contrast to Victoria, where hotels have 105 machines, and New South Wales, where many of the clubs have several hundred. In the case of Penrith Panthers, which we mentioned earlier, they have 800 machines. From this, it is obvious that many casinos just don't exist in this state. We have a very stringent monitoring of every machine 24 hours a day via a central independent control system known as the Independent Gaming Corporation. It ensures a high degree of integrity and security, and again, in contrast to other states, this was set up from day one of operation, initiated by the industry and paid for by the private operators. We borrowed $6.25 million to set that up, and the state taxpayers didn't pay a cent. It does not cost the taxpayer $1. In New South Wales, there's never been a central monitoring system. Certainly in Victoria and Queensland, there has been. And now, after 40-plus years of operation, they're going to establish that. Even the contribution to the gamblers' rehabilitation, the rehabilitation of gamblers for that unfortunate 1.2%, and I'll repeat it, Nick, 1.2% of the adult population who get into difficulty with the overuse of machines, was thought of and was initiated by the industry, by the pubs and clubs, from day one, on a voluntary basis. $1.5 million annually is provided to this service by hotels and clubs with gaming. This is a budget per annum larger than the Government Anti-Poverty Fund, which, although recently renamed, has a much wider brief and has a funding ceiling of around $900,000, I understand. It's also an interesting story, if anyone's interested in how that $1.5 million is disposed of. They have difficulty getting rid of it. The industry expanded this by producing Smart Play, a guide and message for players to gamble in control and where to go for assistance, a staff procedures booklet and a comprehensive training for staff on being sensitive to and how to intervene with problem gamblers was also developed and implemented. This was an all-Australian first, and sections of it have been replicated right across Australia, and how good it is and how well regarded it is. In fact, as I speak now, our community and public relations officer, Margot McGregor, who many of you know, is in Munich speaking at an international gambling conference on this industry's response to problem gambling. This is the second invitation within 12 months and is indicative of the credibility of that initiative. The sad part is that it has received more praise interstate and overseas than it has in our own backyard. Neither the government, the TAB, the Lotteries Commission or the casino contribute one single dollar to gamblers' rehabilitation services in this state. One question we've been asking for 4 years now is a fundamental one. Why is greater pressure not brought to bear on the other gambling codes to contribute when there is clearly good research showing that problem gamblers exist in all forms of gambling? Maybe we have to wait for these franchises to be privatised for that pressure for them to contribute. One Adelaide-based psychologist and gambling researcher, John O'Connor of the Flinders University, in evidence before the Social Development Committee inquiry, stated that as many as one-third of punters involved with the TAB are at risk, which is a different expression, I think, of becoming problem gamblers. He also said that the equivalent gaming machine figure was 5%. That never made any news, but I think it ought to have. We can't help but wonder if this has anything to do with the unique relationship between the print media and the TAB form guide that is printed and distributed around the state. One story that did make front page news, in fact, was when a problem keno gambler who attempted an armed robbery with a plastic replica pistol, as I recall, the story was featured in colour on the front page of our local newspaper, but it was turned into a pokey story, even though the woman had not played machines. Yet again, and the point about that is that yet again it created an inaccurate perception. The Lotteries Commission would have us believe that they do not contribute to problem gamblers, when research shows quite clearly that they do. And if hotels advertise gaming products as aggressively as the Commission, all hell would break loose in this community. I encourage you to compare our industry's advertising and promotion of gaming to those government-owned instrumentalities. In fact, the Gaming Commissioner acknowledged, when he appeared before the Social Development Committee inquiry, he acknowledged that if the poker machine industry advertised in that same manner, he would have no option to intervene. I think I've quoted his word perfectly there. The media show us regularly there is a national explosion in Australian gambling habits, but it is an important question as to why everyone has become obsessed with poker machines rather than looking at gambling as a generic social issue. Locally, we need to remember that we do not have a Crown Casino, a Star City Casino, or 85,000 machines like New South Wales. We are a controlled boutique market. It is fair to say that hotels have felt somewhat under the fire in the past few years with how hotels with gaming machines have been singled out as the root of all evil. They've been blamed for every failed used car dealership, despite the receiver manager's report. A 100-year-old furniture business going broke, a curtain shop, a gun shop, and even an international hospitality chain based out of Hong Kong. That latter example was particularly interesting because it saw a Hong Kong-based company buy and then quickly sell off its operations in four other states at the same time. Only in South Australia were the poker machines blamed for the chain's demise. There were clearly bad business decisions and poor financial planning involved, or maybe something more sinister, but no one seemed to be able to get on top of that. In many other cases, the media has been too willing, in our view, to follow the populist line and do not subject such claims to any rigorous analysis. The outcome of such reporting has formed the perception that any negative regarding gaming machines are much larger than they are in actual fact. I do not believe that such an approach, regardless of what the issue is, serves the community well. A mate of mine studied journalism at McGill some years ago, and he tells me that the first point in the Australian Journalists Association's code of practice or their code is, and I quote from what he told me, "They shall report and interpret the news with scrupulous honesty by striving to disclose all essential facts and by not suppressing relevant, available facts or distorting by wrong or proper emphasis." Now, if there's anyone, I do have copies of that if there's anyone who'd like. It is my view that many reports in relation to poker machines have not conformed to that clause of your code, I guess is the point. Do not take from what I'm saying that I believe there is not some substance to some of the claims that are being made. We live in a rapidly changing times. The leisure dollar is fiercely competed for between cafes, restaurants, amusement parks, family holidays, education, takeaway food, and a host of other areas. Poker machines may have certainly diverted some of the funds from certain areas of our competitors' business, but we argue that many of the claims from the retail sector in particular have come from a result of the dynamic change within the retail sector itself. The corner deli has suffered greater damage from last petrol station convenience shopping than from poker machines. The large retail chains and mega shopping complexes have done more damage to smaller strip shopping centres than poker machines. Consumers' uptake of items such as mobile phones, home computers, laptop computers, and the South Australian preoccupation with AFL football have diverted more dollars from traditional spending than have poker machines. The Retail Traders Association has publicly stated that only about a 2% diversion from retail has gone to poker machines. In any event, the leisure dollar has grown by more than $1 million a day in the last 4 years from growth in our economy at large. The AHA's view is that the only way to dispel some of the myths, which has been given a larger-than-life status, is to look at the issues from the basis of fact. Some time ago, we called for an independent economic impact study to be undertaken by the government. This media release got minimal coverage in the media, and to date, the government has been disinclined to move on such a study. We believe it would be in everyone's best interest to have this occur. Such an inquiry would only enhance the extensive work done by the Parliamentary Social Development Committee inquiry into the impact of gambling, to which the AHA has provided evidence and cooperated fully with. We await this committee's review and findings in the next couple of months. On the subject of inquiries, the federal government's announcement of a productivity commission inquiry into the impact of gambling nationally is an interesting recent move. I think our state premier, John Olsen, and Jeff Kennett were right in their seemingly cynical view. It's probably the first step in a move for the federal government to move revenue from gambling taxes into the federal arena, just as recently occurred with the collection of alcohol, tobacco and petrol taxes. The Feds need to assume some level of control over gambling taxes if they are able to be if they are able to impose a GST on it, because it's the only way that they can achieve anything like cost neutrality on gaming is to have control of it. I think on reflection our industry would have to support that. The recent proposed tax increases on our industry, which I'm anxious to talk about, will see South Australian hotels paying well above the national average rate on gaming. We were incidentally already paying the highest average tax rate in the country prior to the increase that applies as of yesterday. Needless to say, we now believe hotels might be treated more fairly if we were taxed under a federal regime. Certainly they might choose to negotiate directly with us rather than let us find out about a major change through a leak. Selected leak, but anyway, you guys live with it. And if we use the alcohol model as an example, the highest paying tax rate would have to drop to the national average. That's what happened when they took away from the states the tax on the state tax on alcohol, and that in fact cost us a small increase. We have already commenced our own investigation as to whether that move would be a good one from our support, but I think it would save us money. I should add that I don't think restricted gaming licences should be. I do believe that they should be highly taxed. I have no difficulty with that. I have never been an advocate of the 6% gaming tax that applies in Nevada, or the 22% maximum tax rate that applies to clubs in New South Wales. However, we have endured a 51% increase from an average of 33% in 94.5 to 50.5% this year we've just commenced. Now, over a three-year period, that is within the time cycle of a normal business plan. If you think about it, as you can well imagine, these damn bank managers have stopped returning our phone calls again. Like, really, any bank manager is going to ask questions about an industry that doesn't know what its cost of doing business is year on year. I'd like now to mention some of the idiosyncrasies of the latest budget attack on our industry. This, as was written up in the press, was to be the budget that sorted out the big boys of the pokey business. In reality, there is only one Mr. Big of pokies, and it's down on North Terrace, and it's the casino. The casino gets a flat rate of 43.5% tax on its poker machines, lower than a mate of mine has got a pub out in the eastern suburbs with 23 machines. He is going to have a higher average rate than 43.5, and the casino has got on its 650 poker machines. We also believe that the casino enjoys some marketing cost concessions in the calculation of its base for the purpose of calculating its tax. We may consider, and in fact have considered, using freedom of information legislation to establish the facts on that. Why wouldn't our boutique operators have the same tax deal as the casino with 650 machines? Maybe it relates to the government's equity in that enterprise, which sounds like one mother of all conflicts of interest to me. In January 96, we agreed to guarantee a pokie tax of $146 million for the 96-7 fiscal year. We later we fell short by $11 million, as some of you would recall. We later negotiated a 0.5% rate, a loading for the recovery of that $11 million shortfall. Now, the latest budget has torn up that deal. There was a new rate struck at that time, 35%, 37.5% and 40% as a result of the $11 million shortfall. 0.5 was a loading for that. Now, we regret it, But the government tore up that deal on the 28th of May or whatever it was this year when they announced the new budget. But they have left the 0.5% loading there. Now, I haven't heard anyone that doesn't think that's a cheat. In fact, I think the Treasurer thinks it's a bit of a cheat. And we live in hope that the Independents and Labor will combine to bring some justice on that particular issue. I would suggest to you also that they're telling white ones, and I think you know what a white one is without me using the other word, about how much they expect to receive from pokey tax in 98-9. They were budgeting on, I think it was $150 million for 97-8. Mr Lucas said in his budget that the new tax rate, maximum tax rate of 50.5%, would earn an extra $8 million. Now, we can all add $8 million to the base. Incidentally, the 150 will have been overrun by $10 million, the actual receipt on the 10th of this month. And I haven't seen the June figures, but I know enough about it to know that it'll, in fact, be in excess of $160 million. But I happened to attend a hearing the day after the budget, or 2 days after the budget, I think it was one day after the budget, of the Social Development Committee. And there, a senior Treasury official, somewhat hesitatingly because he hated the question, stated on the record, I repeat, on the record, that they were expecting $174.4 million in fiscal 98-9. Something there doesn't add up. I've already mentioned that we believe, particularly in light of the chairman of the National Competition Council, Graham Simons, he was on the Jeremy Cordeau show about 2 months ago, and I quote from what he said on Jeremy's show, that any anti-competitive legislation was non-compliant to the competition policy, he meant there, my words, unless justified by net community benefit. And he added, and community means the whole community, not a privileged group of the community. In most cases, this is still his words, in most cases where privileged argue net community benefit, what they mean is net private interest group benefit or net privileged group benefit. We would argue that the government are running an extreme risk of breaching that national competition policy and therefore putting the government at risk of significant penalties in the competition grants, which for this state, Graham Samuels said, I don't know, but Graham Samuels said on radio that morning, is about $1.4 billion over a period of time. As I referred, this tax hike was the third consecutive increase. That's made our bankers very nervous, and that's particularly important to us at this point in time because 89 of our members will be approaching their bankers for funding so they can complete their buyout of their previous South Australian Brewing Company lease. The sun sets on the joint ventures that our members are involved with SA Brewing in August of next year. I would say that our members will be going out to the banking public at about this time next year looking to borrow $80 million or so, because there's still some debt from the acquisition of the first half. So that'll become a serious issue then. I'm hoping that we get some assurance from the government, and I should add that they are reacting positively to that request, that they will not either move or support anyone else's move for increases in tax beyond that savage attack that they took in May this year. It would be inappropriate to wind up today without mentioning the Honourable Nick Xenophon, who is with us today, and welcome, Nick. I'm delighted that you're here. I understand that Nick... Oh, sorry, I didn't mean... I understand that Nick has recently returned from an extensive tour of Las Vegas in America, where he met with Ralph Nader and others to gain support for his views. Mr. Xenophon, in our view, is a man determined to devastate the hotel industry. He denies this, of course, and believes that he has a right on his side, and I think I'm quoting him correctly here in saying on one occasion that he has overwhelming majority of community support. And I picked that quote out in particular because I disagree with it. Given that, I think I'm correct, and I'll have to be very careful to be correct, I'm sure, that he only achieved 2.74% of the primary vote, which was less than the informal vote, and insufficient to fill a quota for the upper house position. But to his great credit, Nick had negotiated preference flows from all the other minor parties, which led to his election, and he is legally there. I think the shame there is on the major parties for enabling him to crumb all the minor party preferences. At this point, I want to draw an analogy between the Xenophon factor and the Hansen factor. And, Nick, I assure you that I'm not philosophically aligning you with Pauline Hansen at all. I hasten to add that. But there are other points of similarity. Their profiles were created to some degree and certainly enhanced by a very zealous media, greedy for simplistic headlines and the quick two-minute grab. Both politicians have cleverly engaged the disenfranchised among the electorate at a time when the voting public was sick of mainstream parties. Both, in my view, lack clear policy to speak of, and both deeply believe in the truth of their own press releases. Both represent issues which cause much emotional debate, polarise communities, and make everyone an instant expert. I don't suggest either of these outcomes is entirely the fault of the media. Nothing is singular causal. However, I do think that on each occasion the media played an important role in fueling the rise of these individuals. And I am, for one, not convinced that the community in the end is necessarily better off. You're all acutely aware of your own power, I'm now referring to people from the media, to shape community values and standards. The media and the individuals who make up your profession play an enormously influential role in the making or breaking of individual industries. Much of what you cover is done well and with magnificent insight. As both a consumer of your product and as a person often on the receiving end of your journalistic and editorial intervention, my challenge to you is to strive for balance. And that's why I'm here really today, ladies and gentlemen, is just to ask for balance. I would like individual journalists to replace what is often their own value judgments projected onto the issue of poker machines with genuine inquiry. We're very happy with genuine inquiry. And for editors to allow headlines to fit the facts revealed in informed stories rather than trying to make a story fit a predetermined headline. I make this comment having particular regard to the fact that we live in a city where the print media provides little or no room for alternate views. I realise these comments may be unpalatable to some, but they are, however, a perspective from an industry which is a major player in the state's economy and social well-being, representing 600 members and 17,000 individual employees. When stories about major tax increases are told to us via official leaks to journalists, you can't really expect the players in our industry to be happy. It is our view, it's just disrespectful. My experience of the hotel industry is quite a different one to the way others see it. It is an industry which reflects great diversity amongst its members, but a group of people who show enormous generosity to their local communities and who will continue to play an important social role in bringing people together to meet, to have fun and to be entertained, whatever their poison. I think it's too good an opportunity to let pass today without mentioning that tomorrow our association loses the services of Ian Horne to the Motor Traders Association. Ian has given us magnificent service. He's a great strategist. I think he's amongst the best political lobbyists in the state, and he's become a great friend of our industry and a great friend to both me and my family. We will miss him, And we also wish Ian publicly well in his new career direction. I think it's appropriate to thank the media who have shown our industry through Ian courtesy over the years. However, in thanking you for that courtesy that you've extended to him, I implore you to ignore him when he rings you in the next few weeks talking about the virtues of poker machines and booze being available in service stations. You may not know that Ian's father is a senior pastor of the Church of Christ, and I reckon that Ian has done a set for a guy that grew up in the Church of Christ manse down at Cowandilla. He's done a sensational job of representing the industry, the booze and gambling industry of this state. Thank you, Ian, and all the best. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been selling the non-necessities of life forever, but the important sin services of booze and fags and gambling. It is a wonderful industry. I love it. We've been the collectors of tax forever, and may the sinning continue. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Peter. I'm sure that Peter doesn't want to take questions, but we're going to do it very fast and you're going to give some very succinct and quick answers. Questions from the working media first, please, and state your name and where you're from.
Ian Horn put his hand up. Yes, Steve.
Steve Howard from The Advertiser.
Ah.
Mr. Hurley. When I first greeted you when you arrived, you said you'd have to change your speech. I don't know what to. Firstly, I'd just like to say welcome to Bob Bailey. And I hope the Clydesdales are tied up out the front. But Peter, yes. I suppose I could demand the right of reply, but I won't. Mm-hmm. You're the guest of honour and you've had your say, and I must say it was a very well-structured and delivered speech. We were largely the brunt of it, being the advertiser, but we're big enough to cop that. A couple of points that I'd just like to make. You can't always blame us for what people say. If they say it to us,
certainly,
we can't be blamed for publishing it. You will argue that we give it prominence. That's probably right, but it is a social issue, and we try to address it. As far as your point about alternate views not being delivered, we could probably step outside and argue about that one. But one thing I would say that as a lad growing up in New South Wales, that state that's had poker machines for many, many years, and play football as it should be played. I just take issue with one point you make, talking about community donation.
Yep.
And you quoted percentages, which I don't quite recall now, but I'd ask you the differentiation between community donation and community support. As a kid growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney, I played football, rugby league, for a lot of years, and not once did my family have to buy a jersey, a pair of shorts, a pair of socks, pay for a bus trip to a barbecue, for an end-of-year trip. Not once. That was all supported by the Guildford Leagues Club. And obviously that came from poker machines. Can you tell me that difference between the definition that you have of community donation to community support? And one other little question that I like to ask you on a personal basis, why don't I ever bloody win on the pokies?
You must be unlucky, Steve, not that I ever thought so. But to your more serious question, the 11 clubs that were surveyed, the sporting contributions were included. I read it this morning, so it's fresh in my mind. There were Canterbury Leagues Club was one. There were two sporting clubs of a rugby nature like the one that you're mentioning, like the specific example that you're citing, and they were included in the heading that I used, their contribution, which of course is still a large amount of money. The average of the, across the 11, although I think it was 4 of the 11 made no contribution, the average across the 11, their contribution towards sport was still average $60,000 a club. I acknowledge that that would be the case, but given that the break-up of the 11 clubs that were surveyed, there were only 2 that were involved in football, where I'm sure that, and they did mention that there was a greater proportion of support went to the sport in those cases than in the other 9 that were surveyed.
In front here, Mignon Ellicott, formerly ABC. Peter Hurley, as a virtual loser at the pokies, may I have the temerity to ask you if the hotels have the power to alter or adjust the machines, or are they controlled centrally always?
Yeah. Thank you for that question, Mignon. I was, that's an important question, and one that, in my view, there's a lot of misconception about. No, they are not controllable by the venue at all. What happened, the venues buy a game type which they know what the mathematical chance is on that machine, and they have absolutely no control to ever change it. And from the day they put it in, the punter's chance of winning or losing is determined by a random number generator within the game. So the venue has absolutely no control over that whatsoever. Like, people like myself are still not allowed to play them because there is some, presumably, there was some thought that that may have been the case, but it's definitely not the case.
Judith, you have one up the back there?
Yes, hello, Peter. Marianne Stenberg, Senator Grant Chapman's office. I suggest you're not going to get the Advertiser Hotel of the Year award, and you wouldn't have got the pokies vote anyway.
Thanks, Maria.
Okay. Senator Chapman has publicly raised concerns about internet gambling. Do you believe existing facilities provide sufficient gambling opportunities, and are there real dangers in legalising this additional, potentially hidden form of gambling in the home?
Yes, I do think there's sufficient opportunity. I think we're the good guys of the system. I think it would be very bad for the community if people were able to sit at home and gamble and there was no community benefit. I never at any stage inferred that the community benefit from gambling came in the form of the taxes that are paid voluntarily from that form of entertainment, and that would otherwise have to be paid by the broader community. Clearly, if there was capacity for gambling on the internet, the state wouldn't have the capacity to generate the 50.5% from that, and therefore, on that argument alone, it would be undesirable. If Senator Chapman is able to initiate legislation that prevents that from being the case, it would have the broad support of our industry. Yes, Nick.
Peter, Nick Xenophon, it would be remiss of me not to say something because the press club invited me here and paid for my lunch, so I think they should get their money's worth out of me.
Thanks for letting us know that.
Peter, rather than attempt to debate the issues with you, if I could just quote something from, well, firstly in relation to Pauline Hanson, I've said a number of times publicly that I repudiate what she stands for, although I would like to swap my percentage vote for hers. In terms of the Australian Hotels Association, back in 1987, when there was a move to put pokies in clubs only, your current executive director, Ian Horne, who I'm personally very fond of, wrote to all parliamentarians and said that there is little doubt that the poker machine issue will be raised again during this coming session of State Parliament by those seeking a privileged financial advantage in the community. And he went on to say, this form of impulse gambling will only result in even more competition for the already stretched leisure dollar, and went on to say that for licensed clubs to make the money that they expect to make out of poker machines, the turnover of each machine must go far beyond the gambling budget of the average club member or guest. Now, my question to you, Peter, are two things. Firstly, what's happened since 1987? And secondly, will the Hotels Association decide to accept my offer to have a series of public debates out in the community on this issue? The association's declined, but I'm game if you are.
Thanks, Nick. Yes, I think the best response to that letter, which we still stand by, is to quote one of South Australia's quite famous politicians, seeing you're a politician, Nick, when Don Dunstan was asked by a member of the press many years ago why he had just supported a motion as Premier that he had voted against in the previous, I think it was Steele Hall government, he replied, "When things are different, they're not the same." And that'd be my response to that. Well, I still stand by that letter. I think it was an outstanding letter, Ian. You got away to a good start there. the public debate question. I'm not sure we like your style of public debate, Nick. We don't mind debating the issues with you at all, but we're not fond of perhaps... we don't see that anything would be added by the particular forum that you would perhaps prefer.
Next.
Yes, Tara.
Peter, I think I'm here for balance as well. and we seem to have moved beyond working journalists. Gerard Messers from Anglicare. Given I'm in a journalistic setting, I should declare a conflict of interest. The Hotels Association donates $50,000 to us, of which we're very thankful, and we have no truck with the Hotels Association. And I was looking for some other points of commonality, Peter, and as I heard you speak, I think you and I share the same notion. Poker machines are more trouble than they're worth. and I hope you come back for John Hewison, because the tax reform debate seems to be on top of both our minds. But I think that the point that I would make is that we feel poker machines are a different form of gambling. They are an insidious form of gambling, and essentially we see them as really evil. And I've heard your talk, and it was really about the ends justifying the means, but there was a lot of difficulty that you were facing with the poker machine. So in fact I do have a serious question, that is, are they really worth the trouble?
In response to your final question, yes, they are worth the trouble. They are underwriting the viability of our industry now, and we can't live without them. Everything else I have no problem with, but it, obviously I'm not suitably equipped to analyse whether they are a different form of gambling. But those people who specialise in research on that very fact can't make any distinction, time and again. Help me, Ian, the woman from Sydney, Jan McMullen, she makes no distinction at all. I think the biggest single distinction between poker machines and other forms of gambling, in particular the wagering business, which has traditionally been most strongly based on horse racing, is that it appeals to a lot more women. And I think that that's what's caused a considerable amount of the anxiety in community. They didn't mind when it was men going out and punting, using perhaps family revenue for punting, but there has been considerable more anxiety about it when women, when a higher percentage of women choose poker machines as a form of entertainment than are attracted to the more traditional form of gambling through wagering.
One final question. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Robert Gillies from Macmon. We're a very proud supplier to the hotel and hospitality industry and employ 46 people in South Australia. Peter, of the $12 million that is going to be lost from our industry and go to this government, how much of that would have been put back into suppliers such as Macmont to provide us with enough funds to continue to employ 47 people?
Thank you, Rob. Well, one thing about the additional 12 million or whatever it happens to be is I suppose that 48.7% of it would have otherwise gone to the federal pool. So really it's a take from one pool to another, or 48.7% of it is. So we're only really debating the other 50%. Now, there's been a considerable amount written about, you know, the revenue going straight into the pocket of sort of filthy capitalists, which I don't particularly subscribe to. You know, I reckon I'd have no more pairs of socks in my wardrobe than Steve Howard, or probably less suits. But but you know, we all have similar needs. What I'm really saying is that the hotel and club industry, in my view, but the hotel industry is the one that I speak for, have invested back in infrastructure, which is for the benefit of particularly the tourism industry. I know we have upgraded every bedroom and every toilet in our hotels, and that's good for South Australia. That's where the vast majority of the remaining 52 cents goes.
Thank you, Peter. May I just say one final thing, as the Executive Director of the Variety Club of South Australia, that I personally walked into the Hotels Association and asked these guys for a donation of $500,000 to build a hydrotherapy pool at the Women's and Children's Hospital, and that money was provided and that pool is now operational. I would also like to add one final thing and say that the Variety Clubs International, at their convention 2 months ago in Toronto, where I was, honoured the Australian Hotels Association. Thank you, Peter. Would you please thank Peter today?
Thank you for mentioning that. Unfortunately, we were able to do that when our tax rate was 33%, not 50.5%. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Peter.